We are in Joshua chapter 5 tonight. On Thursday evenings, we are making our way through part of the Old Testament, one of the books, Book of Joshua, which records Israel after they've left Egypt, after their time of wandering in the wilderness, and them now taking possession of the promises of God. God had promised them this land of abundance, flowing with milk and honey, and it was just an expression of affluence and abundance and just lots of blessings. And so now they are entering into that. And it's a picture of us as Christians that God has given us a good life in Christ. There are many great things that we can experience and enjoy, and he wants us to enter into that. Not just know it intellectually, not just think, yeah, this is for us down the road, but God has given us a good life here and now to experience. So tonight we're going to be in chapter 5, and you could title chapter 5, Bowing Before the Battle. In the last couple chapters, we looked at D-Day. They basically crossed over the Jordan. They established a beachhead on the other side in the enemy territory, their promised land. And what we're going to see here is an interesting strategy. When the Allies landed in Normandy, they had the Germans on the run, and they were, you know, fleeing. And they took that opportunity while everybody's on the run to continue to advance. And the Israelites don't do that here. They pause and they camp out, and God says it's time for a holiday, and it's time for a pause, and there's something else. We're going to see what it is that I want you to do. And we'll see the purpose of this is outward accomplishments always take place, a second place, to matters of the heart. And there are a few different matters of the heart for God's people that God needed to deal with before taking them further up and further in. And it's an often repeated lesson throughout the Bible. In Israel's case here, there's a few things that they had neglected to do over the years. And so God is reminding them of them. He's not rebuking them, but he is reminding them. And so they get these things established, and then they're going to proceed to take Jericho in the next chapter. But it's four sections that we'll look at. And for the sake of just my own memory, I titled them all with F's. We've got fear, faith, fruit, and then bare feet. And so we'll look at those. Let's go ahead and look at verse 1 here first on the subject of the enemy's fear. Verse 1. So it was when all the kings of the Amorites who were on the west side of the Jordan and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan from before the children of Israel until we had crossed over, that their heart melted, and there was no spirit in them any longer because of the children of Israel. Picture yourself being the enemies of God here, and you're on the other side, and you've heard what God has done for this group of people down in Egypt, all the plagues that happened down there, and the way that God brought them out, and then the parting of the Red Sea, and then God's provision for them in the wilderness, and now the latest installment of God's wonders is he just stops the river, puts his hand right there, and the river backflows, and they're just able to all cross on dry land. And if I was one of the people in Jericho, and I wasn't Rahab, I hadn't been given the promise, I'm going to be delivered, I'm going to be saved, I'd be quite scared. I'd be nervous. Not because of the Israelites, but because of the Israelites' God, who they're serving. And one of the things I see in this verse is the enemy's days, they were numbered, even when they weren't yet conquered. And that's the same case in our lives. We have an enemy that is defeated, and he's still roaming around in this world, but basically, God's created the coffin already, and he's ready to put him in at some point in time. Jesus' work on the cross disarmed and defeated Satan and sin and death, and his resurrection guaranteed it. And basically, remember when Jesus was walking this earth, and before he ever started his public ministry, he was a carpenter. And I'm sure he made many things. I don't know if he ever made a coffin, but his resurrection, his crucifixion, that was him making a coffin for the enemy. He says, I'm going to put you in this, and you're going to be buried and taken care of. In Colossians 2:15, Paul writes, having disarmed, speaking of Christ, principalities and powers, he made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them in it. Romans 6:6. knowing this, that our old man was crucified with them, that the body of sin might be done away with, that we should be no longer slaves of sin. Revelation 12, 7, and then part of 12. The dragon and his angels fought, but they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you having great wrath, because he knows that his time is short. And the devil's time is short, and I think he knows it. And he's at work in this world, but as we see here, he's not yet fully conquered, but his days are numbered. And it's the same with us. We fight a defeated enemy. And it's because of the Lord who's with us. So that is the enemy, their fear. And then we see the Israelites' faith in verse 2. It says in verse 2, at that time the Lord said to Joshua, make flint knives for yourself and circumcise the sons of Israel again the second time. Now if you were Joshua, you'd be thinking, this is bad timing. It's not the right time to be able to do this. Let's attack some more. Let's subdue all the people. And then we will follow through with this. Or why don't we do it on the other side of the river when we had that as a barrier? We'll do it over there and then we'll cross over. And God had them cross over. And he says, okay, one other thing here before you attack Jericho. All the males, all the guys, you got to drop your drawers. And we've got to go through this surgery here. And so they do. Verse 3, so Joshua made flint knives for himself and circumcised the sons of Israel at the hill of foreskins. And this is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. All the people who came out of Egypt were males. All the men of war had died in the wilderness on the way after they had come out of Egypt. For all the people who came out had been circumcised. But all the people who were born in the wilderness on the way as they came out of Egypt had not been circumcised. And the children of Israel walked 40 years, and it's a general term, it's about 38 years that they're in the wilderness, till all the people who were men of war who came out of Egypt were consumed, because they did not obey the voice of the Lord, to whom the Lord swore that he would not show them the land which the Lord had sworn to their fathers, that he would give us, a land flowing with milk and honey. So Joshua circumcised their sons, whom he had raised up in their place, for they were uncircumcised because they had not been circumcised on the way. And so it was, when they had finished circumcising all the people, that they stayed in their places in the camp until they were healed. So we've got here this procedure that God instructed for the Israelites to do to all the men. And this is a different expression of faith than what we saw in the earlier chapters. In the last couple chapters, we saw faith taking steps, faith getting its feet wet, faith proceeding. Here we see faith stopping, faith waiting, faith not stepping out, but holding back. And it takes faith to do both. There's times in life that God has called us to step out. There's other times God calls us to wait. And it takes discernment and His Spirit to know when is the case. But here is a time where God says, before you step any further, I want you to wait here and perform this act. And again, this isn't your typical strategy. Think of the Allies on the banks of Normandy when they crossed over. It would be utter folly, naturally, to disable your entire army that you just put into enemy territory. If you just took away all their resources and made them completely vulnerable. But that's what the Israelites are doing here. By circumcising all the men, they're taking all their soldiers and they're making them incapable of fighting. There's a story in the book of Genesis, in Genesis chapter 34. Jacob had 12 sons and he had a daughter. And there's a sad situation that took place with his daughter and two of his daughter's brothers. Her brothers, two of his sons, got extremely angry over this. She'd been assaulted. And so the person who had, violated her, wanted to marry her. And so the guy came to the family, and he was nice, and he was a heathen. He wasn't following the Lord. And so he says, I'd like to marry this young lady. And what had taken place was just tragic to the whole family. And Jacob had difficult words. He didn't even know really what to say. These two brothers came up with a plan. He says, okay, you can marry. our sister. But under the condition that you have all your men be circumcised, because we're Jews and we're following the Lord, and this is a custom that God has given to us. And they weren't actually asking them to become proselytes and become Jewish. It was a ploy. And so the guy went back. He thought, okay, I love this woman. I want to marry her. And so he went back to his tribe. And he says, this is what they've asked us to do. And so they perform it. And then this is a whole group of people, and just these two men, Levi and Simeon, go in on the third day. They just walk from house to house and they kill all the guys because none of them were capable of defending themselves. And here in this story, God has all of his army, his human army, hindered in a sense, or they are unable to defend themselves for this time. And from, again, a natural perspective, it seems not normal or bad wisdom. And yet, in all reality, Israel had a better army protecting them. They couldn't have been more safe. And God knew the enemy is so scared, they are holed up in Jericho and they are not coming out. They have no idea, you know, that we're doing this. And so God had that under control. But even if they had come and attacked, there's a verse in Psalm 34:7 that the angel of the Lord encamps around all those who fear him and delivers them. There's a story in 2 Kings 6 of Elisha, and he has a servant, and some enemies are coming to him, and they're surrounded, and the servant is completely scared, and Elisha asks God to open his servant's eyes, and he opens his eyes, and he sees all around them are chariots and a fire and the angels. Basically, God's protecting and defending, and God was surrounding his people here in the midst of this time. So, why does God have them do this so? Back in Genesis 17, God had given circumcision to the Jews as a sign of the covenant. And a sign is a visible picture of a spiritual reality. That God had called them for their nation to be circumcised. And circumcision, it didn't save them. Abraham was saved decades before, or years before, he ever performed circumcision. Romans 4, verses 9 through 12 emphasize that. But again, it was to be a sign of God's work in their life and their commitment to seeing him carry this out to completion. It was a picture of the cutting away of the flesh or the self-life. And in Deuteronomy chapter 30, verse 6, we see what it really represented in the heart. And the Lord your God will circumcise your heart and the heart of your descendants, or cut away the flesh, the self-life, to love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, that you may live. And so for them as a nation, they were supposed to perform this sign. And when they were in the wilderness, they had parents that had neglected this. And so we have a whole new generation that's grown up. They're supposed to be the children of God, the people of God, and they don't have the sign of God upon them. God has given, thankfully, for the church, a different sign. It's not circumcision, but it's baptism. And it represents a very similar thing. The burial and putting away of the self-life, the old life, and being brought into a new life with Christ. And the benefit of signs is twofold. We still perform signs in other ways today. For example, my wedding ring is a sign. It's a visible picture of a spiritual reality. If I took my wedding ring off, it doesn't mean that I'm not married to Gretchen. But it's a reminder to myself, and it's a testimony to other people that I am committed to my wife. And in a similar way, circumcision was for the Jews, and baptism is for the church. It's that. It's their wedding ring. It's their commitment. It's them showing the world, and it's a reminder for themselves, we are connected to God. And this is what God is promising to do in us. And so, for them as a people, they needed to undergo this. And God instructs them to do this here. At times, God's going to call us and maybe call you and your family. Maybe you're a generation before, there was a neglect of different things. And God will instruct the need to pick up and have us walk in things that the previous generation hadn't walked in. The Israelites here, they needed to pick up things that their parents and their ancestors had set aside. And so, one of the results that we see here in this, in verse 34, verse 9, Then the Lord said to Joshua, "This day I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you." Therefore the name of the place is called Gilgal to this day. And then verse 10. So the children of Israel camped in Gilgal and kept this Passover on the 14th day of the month at twilight on the plains of Jericho. There's two results that we see. One is renewed access to celebrate the Passover, and the other is a reproach is rolled away. God says in verse 9, "This day I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you." And if you remember when they first came to the land about 40 years earlier, God says, "I'm going to destroy the people because of their unbelief." And God says, or Moses spoke with God, and he said to the Lord, "If you kill all your people, your enemies are going to say you weren't able to bring them in. You brought them out of Egypt, but you couldn't bring them into the land." And they're going to mock God. They're going to mock your people. And so here, God is saying to Joshua, the reproach or the mockery of the enemies is put away. It's rolled away because you are in the land and you are my people. And the things that they had said could never happen have actually taken place. And it reminds me that when believers do not enter the fullness of life that we profess, the enemies of God use it as a reason to reproach. If different people profess Christ, but they don't walk with Christ, if they just live their entire life in the wilderness, the enemy of God uses that to mock God and say, "God's not powerful, God's not able, God's not capable." Ravi Zacharias said at one time, I appreciate this statement, and I think it's very true. He says, "I have little doubt that the single greatest obstacle to the impact of the gospel has not been its inability to provide answers, but the failure on our part to live it out." In other words, the failure and neglect of God's people to enter into the land and thus cause the reproach against God and the mockery of God to be rolled away. And so here, God's saying, by you performing this and stepping into the land, the reproach is rolled away, and you guys get to celebrate the Passover. Because in Exodus 12, when God first gave instructions about the Passover, no uncircumcised person could participate in it. They had to be circumcised. And the last time we see the Israelites celebrate this feast is with Moses at Mount Sinai. There's no record of them ever celebrating the Passover in the wilderness. So potentially, it's likely that this is only the third time that they've celebrated this feast. Down in Egypt, at Mount Sinai, and then waiting 40 years because the people weren't circumcised, and celebrating it right here. And so I appreciate that in the midst of this pause that God creates here, he does call them to do some things difficult, circumcision for the men. But there's also some things wonderful, and that's celebrating the feast. And in life, obedience involves some things painful and also many things pleasant. And often it's those painful things, when we obey in the hard things, it often opens up blessings and opportunities to enjoy. So a lesson I see in all of this, before we move on to the next verses, is you can't really experience a full life without forsaking self. That's why God was calling them to circumcise. It was a picture of them cutting away the flesh. And I can't ever enter into the full life of God without letting go of the life of me and the life of self. Jesus said that in Luke 9:24. "If anyone desires to follow me, let him take up his cross daily, deny himself, and follow me." And you've got to die to yourself to enter into the resurrection life. So, as they do, it was partly painful, but also partly wonderful. And it wasn't all circumcision. There was also celebration. It wasn't only the flint knife. It was also a banquet feast. And a question for you to consider before we move on is, are there any areas of neglected obedience in your life? God kind of tapped them on the shoulder here and says, before you go any further, there's a couple areas that you as a nation had just been forgetting. And it wasn't outright obedience. I think they it wasn't part of their custom. They just grew up not doing it. And so God reminds them of it. But are there any things? Is there anything in your life of neglected obedience? And God will remind that to you at times. And when he does, step into it and follow what he says. So the third point we see here is relates to fruit, verse 11 and 12. "And they ate of the produce of the land on the day after the Passover, unleavened bread and parched grain on the very same day. Now the manna ceased on the day after they had eaten the produce of the land. That's amazing to me. For 40 years, they've been, you know, walking out, step outside the doors of their tent, and they've got, you know, bread, Wonder Bread, coming down from the heaven, just right there, every single day. And the day they eat of the food of the land, they step out of their tent doors, and there's no more manna. It's gone. That's it. That era has passed. And the children of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate the food of the land of Canaan that year. What occurred when Israel crossed over is those who lived in the land, they retreated to the cities and they left all their farms there and their silos and all the grain. And so they were just able to enter right in and enjoy all of it. And I think the timing of this, it shows that it is a miracle. It wasn't just some desert phenomenon that out there in the wilderness, stuff just falls from the sky and it just happens to everybody. The day that they had other provision, God stopped this other work. And it definitely was a miracle. And I think there's probably a twofold response. If you're the Israelites, for the great majority of people, there's probably great joy. It's the last of the MREs. The manna ready to eat. Don't have to go outside anymore. There's no more manna cotti. There's no more manna cakes. There's no more manna muffins. There's no more recipes. You know, you can throw away those 101 ways to prepare manna books. It's all gone. And how wonderful to experience now some more diversity in what you can eat and all these different things that God had given. But I imagine that for some, there was a little bit of disappointment. The lazy in the crowd, you know, like, you mean now I have to go forage around in the land and get food? I can't just walk outside, you know, reach out and just be lazy? And I don't think it's so much that they loved manna, but I think they enjoyed, probably to a degree, the convenience of having bread fall from the sky every day, and they didn't have to go do much. And yet, this change, it was going to involve more work, and we're going to see one of the reasons for that. But a lesson in this is not to expect miracles when other means are available. That when God provides other means that are natural, don't look for a miracle. And often people have this question of why doesn't God perform miracles in the U.S.? And some people say it's just because of our great unbelief. And to a degree, that may be the case. We just maybe don't believe as much. But I think another reason is God has provided so many other means through which He works. And He said, utilize these means and access them. These are things I've given to you, and I'm going to provide for you through this and not just the miraculous. Arthur Pink says, we are not to expect extraordinary supplies when they can be had in an ordinary way. God works no unnecessary miracles. And one part of the maturity process is responsibility. In Israel, they're moving into a new season. They're growing up, in a sense, as a nation. And part of this is them needing to step out and find this daily bread in other ways. God's still going to provide the daily bread, but it's going to be in a different way, not the same old way. And so, maybe for you, we're talking about the Mexico trip this summer and the cost. Let's say it's $500. I don't know how much it's going to be exactly yet, but let's pick $500. $500 is a chunk of money if you don't have a regular job, if you're one of the youth in here or something, and you think, okay, how's God going to provide for this? Or when I was, getting ready to go to Bible college and the cost of that. And God sometimes provides through Him just dropping things in our lap, and God sometimes also provides through Him saying, you need to go out and work. And both, He does both. And I have been provided at times in trips and in life, sometimes through people just being generous toward me and just blessing me. I remember, I think it was my first Mexico trip. I got $150 just from somewhere around there, just from a person in the church. And it was just a huge blessing to me. Other times, though, I raised every penny of that myself. And it was me who, it was God telling me, you've got to use the talents and the gifts and just the hard work that I've given you to go out and work the land so that you can provide and participate in something. So, maybe there's an area in life that you're looking for a miracle and God's expecting you to work. And then the last point we see here is bare feet in verses 13 through 15. And it came to pass when Joshua was by Jericho that he lifted his eyes and he looked. And behold, a man stood opposite him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went to him. I think most people would decide, I'm going a different way. But Joshua proceeds. And he said to him, are you for us or for our adversaries? And he said, no. And if you notice, it wasn't a yes or no question. But this man said no. But as commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come. And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped and said to him, what does my Lord say to his servant? Then the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, take your sandal off your foot, for the place where you stand is holy. And Joshua did so. And I would have too, I think. Probably partly because the man has a sword, but also knowing who this man is, that it is Jesus. And so we have here Joshua. It really appears he's out walking, surveying, probably thinking about Jericho. How are we going to take this big city out? And praying probably, and he sees this man. Jesus comes directly to him. And we know it's a Christophany, an appearance of Christ in the Old Testament, by what Jesus says, and also by how Joshua responds. He falls down and he worships this man. And any other angel of God in the Bible, other than the angel of the Lord, they don't accept worship from men. In Revelation 22, verses 8 and 9, John, the apostle, he falls down before one of the angels of the Lord and he worships just because he's overcome by this being. And he picks him up. He says, don't worship me. I'm just, you know, like you. Worship God. And any true angel from the Lord has that response to people when people fall down. And this man doesn't do that. He receives and accepts worship. Just like Jesus in John chapter 20, where Thomas falls before Jesus and he says, my Lord and God, and worships Jesus. Jesus accepts that because he is God. There's two questions that Joshua has here for Jesus. The first is, are you for us or against us? And Jesus corrects him. I was talking to my cousin a few weeks ago about this chapter, and it reminded him of the undercover boss situation where he has no idea that this is Jesus. And he comes in and he approaches him, and Jesus turns things around. He reminds him, lets him know who he is. He dismisses the question, and he says, it's not... I'm not the one who's commanded. I'm the one who gives commands. God's our ally when we declare our allegiance. And here, Joshua here comes before Jesus and he worships. He gives his allegiance. And then he says, what does my Lord say to his servant? And you might think that the first thing out of Jesus' mouth would be instructions for the battle. But it's not. Just like when God was with Moses at the burning bush. Similar situation. This is Joshua's burning bush experience. And God speaks to Moses, and he doesn't say, immediately, get back down to Egypt. I'm going to deliver the people. That's going to be there in the conversation, but the first thing is take off your sandals, for the place where you stand is holy ground, because God is there, and God is holy. And I think the significance to this for Joshua is he's not in charge. He is a man under authority. Even though he is in charge of Israel, he's under God's authority. And it probably gave him great comfort and rest. God's in control. He's here with me before we go into the battle. I'm so thankful that the church is not just in the hands of men. That Jesus said in Matthew 16, I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. And so that would have probably been just great comfort to Joshua and encouragement. But I think there's another lesson for Joshua. And that is, our first line of duty is to bow before God, and only after that are we equipped for the battle. In other words, God is looking for worship and a relationship, and not just work and a responsibility, the things that we do. Here he commands Joshua basically to hang out for a while, take your shoes off. I want to talk to you. I want to relate to you. I want to connect with you. We're going to talk about the battle, but before that, I want you to get to know me. God's always more interested in a relationship than any work we do before him. You think of Mary and Martha in the New Testament. And you see these two sisters, and the one is in the kitchen, and she's just busy working away and just toiling for Jesus, and she gets frustrated at Mary, because Mary's kicking back, and she's relaxing, she's just hanging out at the feet of Jesus. My wife's smiling over there. It's kind of an inside joke thing. But anyway, we can often be like Martha, where we just get so busy with life and so busy with ministry and trying to do things for God and serve God. And God says, you know what? I don't really care about all that stuff. It doesn't really matter to me. Let's just stop right now before doing any of that. Let's just hang out. And if I, as a pastor, if I don't spend time with God, I am not going to be equipped to be the pastor I should be at this church. If I don't spend time with God, if I don't bow before my day, in a sense, pause before the Lord before I start my day, I'm not going to be a good husband. I'm not going to be the right dad. I'm not going to be a good employee or employer, or whatever it is. I need to bow before I go into battle, before I tackle any tasks that are before me. And I think that is a lesson. The Ephesian church in Revelation chapter 2, Jesus was writing to seven of his churches. One church, but you know, seven different areas at that time. And the first church, Ephesus, he says, you guys are doing many good things. So much good stuff that you guys are doing. But you've forgotten the main thing, the one thing that is needed. And that is, spend time with me. And he rebuked them for that. Question that came to my mind as I was, you know, studying and reading this is, when's the last time I or you took off your sandals before the Lord? When's the last time you put down your work and you just paused and you said, God, I just want to know you. I just want to be with you, to spend time with you. Is all of life busyness and business, or are there quiet times of worship? And I'm not saying that worship isn't to be that work isn't to be an expression of worship, but it is only an expression of true worship when our heart is in the right place. And so that I see is basically the whole thrust of this chapter. God's not in a hurry. He's going to take out the Jericho, but he has to line some things with his people. God's delays are not really delays. They're necessary steps of preparation. In C.H. Spurgeon, he said, patience, patience. You are always in a hurry, but God is not. God wants us to redeem the time, but he also calls us to be still and know that he is God. In Ecclesiastes 10:10, Solomon writes about the wisdom of sharpening an axe before swinging it when it's dull. And if I don't spend time before the Lord and I go out and do ministry, it's like swinging a dull axe. I might cut down a couple of trees, but it's a lot more work, and it's not really the way that God has designed it to be. And so there's nothing worse, I think, in ministry or churches than God's servants swinging dull blades because they aren't taking the time to be still before the Lord. And I don't want our ministry, I don't want my sermons to be, you know, dull-bladed sermons. I want them to be ones that really cut, that are effective because we as a people are spending time with the Lord. And so, as we wrap up tonight, I see some gospel connections. I see that it's through the gospel that the enemy is defeated. I see that circumcision and baptism, they're both intended to be a picture of the gospel, the good news and promise of God's work for us and in us. Both of those, they're not statements of our work. They're statements of his work and his guaranteed promise of what he's going to do in us. I see the gospel, it's the greatest miracle, but it also fits us to be practical. And, you know, here, manna ceased, but they're to go and just take provisions in the land. And then I see the gospel is God not just coming to grant victory, but it's him coming to give relationship. That's what heaven's all about. It's not just victory over sin, it's included, but it's relationship with him. And that starts right now. So I just want to encourage you, you know, as we wrap up tonight, to make sure in your week, as you step out of here this evening, that are there times where you go out and you're still before the Lord? You reflect like Joshua. And we don't have those burning bush experiences every day, but we get those when we do go out and we spend time with God. And then sometimes God shows up in special ways like that. But if Moses never traveled to the other side to check out the burning bush, if Joshua hadn't been there, reflecting and walking, meditating, who knows? Maybe God wouldn't have shown up right then. Sometimes God does interrupt just in the midst of people's lives, like Paul. He just knocks him off his high horse as he's on the road to Damascus. Other times God meets us when we go out to meet him. So let me close in prayer, and we'll end with one final song. Lord, we thank you for tonight. We thank you for your word. We thank you, God, that you never rush, that you are never in a hurry. I never see Jesus running in the Bible. And I think you're capable of running. You're able to do things quickly. And there are times when urgency is in place. But at the same time, you are never rushed. You are never flustered. You're never just needing to be like us, where we just get busy, 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 and we neglect the one thing that's needed, as Jesus said to Martha. And help us, Lord, to pause, to be still, and to allow you opportunities and times to show us areas where we maybe are neglecting obedience and pick up something that's been put down for a while. We thank you for this chapter. We thank you for just you taking the time to pause your people. We thank you for your protection over your people, and that they were completely safe, even in the midst of the celebration and Passover and all these things that they were doing. They couldn't have been really attacked because you were there guarding them. We thank you that you guard us as well. Thank you again for tonight. In Jesus' name, amen.